This month, the genes involved in brain cancers and how to use them for treatments.
So given the genetic complexity and the genetic variability from one patient's glioblastoma to another's, it may well require a personalized approach.
And do you fancy yourself as the next Michael Phelps? Find out how his brain, as well as his body, differs from the less athletic.
What we were trying to do was to take neuroscientific work, which is often very much based around the performance of normal people in the lab, and try and see how we could use those sort of neuroscientific theories to explain the top levels of performance, if you like.
Hello and welcome to Neuropod. I'm Kerry Smith. The brain has a very strict door policy, enforced by the ultimate bouncer, the blood-brain barrier. This barrier protects the brain from bacteria and other toxic substances circulating around the rest of the body. But occasionally, guests are allowed in that shouldn't be. In multiple sclerosis, for example, the unwanted guests are immune cells called T cells, which can then attack the nervous system by eating away at the insulation that's wrapped around nerve cells. Finding out how these T cells get into the brain could point researchers to treatments for the disease. To that end, a paper in the July issue of Nature Medicine has found that a molecule called bradykinin receptor 1 helps get T cells on the guest list. Here's lead author Frauke Zipp at the Charité University Hospital in Berlin.
It's considered that the important immune cells which start the whole damage process are T lymphocytes, which are capable of attacking tissue. And these lymphocytes especially have to be inhibited in going into the central nervous system. And one can do that in different ways. One can, first of all, try to limit the activation and the expansion of these T lymphocytes outside of the brain. Then the next step is inhibiting the migration over this barrier, so the transmigration into the central nervous system. The next step to limit disease would be to inhibit the local activation, which then makes these T cells in the end really attacking the CNS. And then, of course, the last possibility to interfere therapeutically would be to really stop them from doing these destructive processes within the central nervous system. So basically, one can say there are four points where one could interfere with this whole pathology. And the process we were working here in our study on is really the transmigration through the blood-brain barrier.
So this is stage two of the process you've just described.
Right.
And here in this new paper of yours in Nature Medicine, you found a new molecule involved, is that right?
Right. We did not find this molecule particularly, it was known, but we found the role of this so-called bradykinin receptor 1 for migration into the central nervous system.
So tell me a little bit about what your study involved then. How did you find this role, this new role for this protein?
So normally, bradykinin receptor 1 is not expressed in the healthy system, but it was known that bradykinin receptor B1 can be upregulated after tissue damage or any insults in the body. This was known, and what we found now that bradykinin receptor 1 is actually expressed on the T cells which migrate through the blood-brain barrier, and once this bradykinin receptor 1 is specifically activated, then the T cells are inhibited, are blocked in their migration into the central nervous system.
And you showed this in mice, is that right? You did a whole series of studies in mice.
Right. The in vivo studies are in mice, and we showed that the bradykinin receptor 1 deficient T cells have an advantage to migrate into the central nervous system. The migration as such was also studied in human T cells with a human blood-brain barrier, so mimicking the transmigration of the T cells into the CNS. So there we could also see that adding a substance activating bradykinin receptor 1 is inhibiting these T cells from migration.
So I suppose one of the obvious questions is, well, if in multiple sclerosis we want to stop these defective T cells getting into the central nervous system and bradykinin 1 could help us do that, is this a possible therapeutic target?
Yeah, that's of course the question. In mice, we have shown that this is a therapeutic target. Definitely, we can dramatically reduce the disease and also dramatically reduce the disease once the disease has already started, which is the situation we have to deal with in patients. To go now into a patient's therapy, this is of course a way to go, which means you add monkey experiments, and then of course the next step is to, or maybe now already in parallel, to involve pharmaceutical industry in order to follow this up and to then develop an agonist which can be applied in patients.
Frauke Zipp there. Find the article online at nature.com/nm. Coming up shortly, we get a close-up look at a curious family of receptors with roles in the brain and beyond. But before that...
alongside him, but here comes Usain Bolt. Usain Bolt streaking away from the field. It's going to be gold for Jamaica. That is superb. It's a new world record.
The Olympics is a showcase of the superlative when it comes to human physical achievement. Higher, faster, longer. We watch these athletes because they are at the upper boundary of human strength, endurance and speed. Psychologists and neuroscientists are interested in them too. What makes them different to the mere mortals who jog once a week and occasionally cycle to the shops? I paid a visit to City University in London, where psychologist Keelan Yarrow told me about the review article on elite athletes that he and his colleagues have written for Nature Reviews Neuroscience.
What we were trying to do was to take neuroscientific work, which is often very much based around the performance of normal people in the lab, and try and make links then with the more cognitive work on the elite performers to see how we could use those sort of neuroscientific theories developed on normals to explain the top levels of performance, if you like.
What kind of models are you talking about when you say you're applying predictions and models that people use to model normal people's behaviour and applying it to elite athletes?
There are quite a number of models in the motor control literature which deal with how we control everyday actions, just quite simple things like reaching and grasping actions, which may seem, because obviously we do them effortlessly, they seem as if there's nothing really to explain there. But if you tried to get a robot to perform the kind of actions that we perform effortlessly, you realise there's actually a great deal to understand about that. So a lot of these models are computational models, which means that what they're doing is they're providing a mathematical basis to transform kind of the sensory input that we receive into a pattern of commands which could be sent to the musculature of the body. They're really kind of sophisticated number crunching models, if you like. I should say that there are a whole range of things that athletes do better, not just the kind of precision and skill of their movements.
And do you think that's quite dynamic whenever a basketball player throws the ball into the hoop? Is it going to be different every time but equally good, or is there just one movement? It's just automatic by that point.
One of the things that kind of comes out of this framework is that a skilled athlete is not just learning a particular movement path and producing that very, very precisely, because often, as you suggested, they're coming at something from different positions of play. So what they're trying to do is to make the ultimate outcome as accurate as possible, say getting that basketball through the hoop. But that might be initiated from a whole range of different positions, so they're going to have to perform this kind of complex computation for their particular circumstance.
You mentioned that there are other things elite athletes are good at, as well as just, movements.
Well, for example, they seem to be very good at making early perceptual decisions. So if you take the example of imagine yourself as a kind of a cricket batsman, maybe in the Ashes or something like that, and you might be facing a nasty Australian fast bowler. And for someone who's not very good at that, if they should find themselves in that unfortunate situation, they might be actually responding to the path of the ball as it travels towards the bat, which kind of seems like the obvious way to do it. But for an advanced cricketer, what they would actually be doing is looking at the movement of the bowler, in particular their kind of their arm and their hand, prior to the moment when the ball is actually released. So they'd be using the information from the bowler's body motion to then predict what the ball is going to do, and that gives them a sort of head start, a temporal advantage. So they can be already getting ready to make the shot which they're expecting at a time when most of us would still be trying to figure out where the ball is going.
Now, I don't know if you went into this in great deal in your article, but I mean, for those of us who aren't elite sports people, how much of this is alterable?
So the first thing to say is that elite sports people practice an enormous amount.
I should have started already for the 2012 Olympics, you mean?
Yeah, definitely so, yeah. So most elite sports people are kind of starting off in their activity when they're about 4 or 5 years of age, and they're practicing very regularly from that point onwards. And the amount of practice they're engaging is increasing slowly over time as well. So practice is really critical, and actually there are quite a few studies showing that just that variable of hours of accumulated practice tends to differentiate quite well between real elite performers and those who maybe haven't quite made it. The alternative perspective is that some people have genetic predispositions or talent or whatever it might be. Those two things are very, very difficult to disentangle scientifically, primarily because the quality of the data is not really up to it. So in most cases, you've got to reconstruct people's practice histories in retrospect, and that introduces all sorts of problems.
And I suppose not only, you know, genetic traits that govern how easily you put on muscle, but also those that govern your psychological aspects, how much you're prepared to do 10,000 hours of training.
Yeah, motivation is clearly a very key constraint. And actually, that's a kind of point of crossover between the two schools, because the sort of psychologists who are very environmentalist will still accept that there may well be a genetic contribution to your willingness, your motivation to engage in practice over long periods of time.
So let's imagine ourselves, you know, maybe a few years in the future. Is there going to be, do you think, ever a battery of tests that athletes or potential athletes will be subject to try and sort out those who are going to become elite athletes much more easily than those who aren't, who'll never make it?
In terms of behavioural tests, probably not. And by behavioural tests, I mean things like your basic visual acuity or your speed of response, your reaction time, those kinds of tests. The evidence seems to be that the things which distinguish experts from novices are quite domain-specific, by which I mean a very good tennis player might very rapidly be able to kind of recall and recognise specific situations from a tennis context and be able to direct their eye movements to exactly where the ball is likely to be and that kind of thing. But they don't tend to be any better than other people on those lower level measures of performance, general visual acuity, that kind of test. So for that reason, it's quite unlikely that just a battery of behavioural tests will do the job. In terms of things like genetic profiling and those more kind of biological aspects, it's certainly possible. I wouldn't say that we're anywhere near it at the moment, but it's certainly possible that those kind of things could happen in the future.
That was City University's Keelan Yarrow. The full review is available at nature.com/NRN. Coming up in just a moment, the genetics of a particularly aggressive brain cancer. First, though, imagine trying to figure out how something works, your car engine or a computer hard drive, without knowing what the bits look like. Pretty tough, right? The same is true in biology, and that's why scientists interested in, for example, a particular receptor, first need to determine its atomic structure. Eric Guo and his team from the Volum Institute at Oregon's Health and Science University have been decoding the structure of a curious set of receptors involved in pain, taste, and some psychiatric disorders. They're called P2X receptors. Eric took time out of his vacation in a remote log cabin in Montana to talk to me about his work, published in Nature this month.
We're reporting the first crystal structure of one set of ion channels called P2X receptors. These are ATP-gated ion channels. And in the second paper, we examine the structure of an acid-sensing ion channel, or an ion channel that's opened by drops in pH, and find that the pore domains of both channels have an unexpected and striking relationship in structure. In other words, they basically look the same. And this is really the first insight into the pore structures of trimeric ion channels like P2X receptors and acid-sensing ion channels.
What do they do exactly? Why are they interesting to neuroscientists?
Oh, well, P2X receptors in particular play an important role in the nervous system, both in the peripheral nervous system and in the central nervous system, because they are opened by ATP. And even though most biologists think of ATP as a carrier of energy or intracellular signaling molecule, ATP is in fact also an extracellular signaling molecule, and these receptors detect very low concentrations of ATP and use this external ATP as a signaling agent for detecting stimuli such as pain.
Where are these channels found? Are they just everywhere in loads of animals? Or?
Well, they're unique to multicellular eukaryotes, to the best of our knowledge. They're not present in bacteria. In humans and in mammals, they're actually spread throughout the body, and in fact, they not only play an important role in the nervous system, but they're also found in cells of the immune system.
So describe the process for the uninitiated then, and I mean, you'll probably have to be quite brief here. How do you get the structure of a channel? How do you look at it?
Oh, well, this was particularly difficult. For the P2X receptors, this was we started the project about 8 years ago, and it was very challenging to find a receptor that was amenable to crystal formation. We depend on three-dimensional crystals for structure determination, and we use these three-dimensional crystals in combination with an X-ray beam to essentially visualize the atoms at the atomic level. And the challenge in this case was simply finding a receptor that was stable enough to yield these well-ordered 3D crystals.
In other words, when you tried to crystallize a particular receptor, it just sort of broke, or what happened?
It just broke, or it aggregated, or it was just very unhappy being outside of the kind of cellular membrane context. And many groups have spent a substantial amount of time trying to discover a P2X receptor that could be crystallized. In my lab, we've developed some technology to help us sift through genes and proteins to find the ones that are most likely to crystallize. And it's by using this technology that we were able to find the zebrafish receptor that just behaves spectacularly and crystallized almost immediately. We were tremendously, tremendously fortunate and thank our zebrafish on a daily basis.
And so, you know, once you'd managed to do this with the extremely cooperative zebrafish, what did you manage to find out about these channels?
On the most fundamental level, we were able to confirm previous findings that these channels are, in fact, trimeric. So that really distinguishes them from tetrameric potassium channels or tetrameric glutamate receptors. And there's really very little known about trimeric ion channel proteins.
What do you mean by trimeric?
So that means that there are three subunits that form an intact ion channel or an intact receptor. And this is in contrast to potassium channels, which require four subunits, or acetylcholine receptors, which require five subunits. And, of course, the second really astonishing feature was that these molecules have ATP binding sites that are different from other ATP binding site yet seen. And this is particularly surprising because ATP and its receptors have been studied for years and years. And I think most people would have believed that all ATP binding proteins have been well characterized so far. But it turns out that P2X receptors have a novel ATP binding motif.
Eric Guo. Finding those papers at nature.com/nature will be easier than finding Eric in his Montana log cabin. Happy holidays, Eric. Finally this month, an article in Nature Reviews Neurology looks at how genetics can help us understand an aggressive kind of brain cancer called glioblastoma. Current treatments have pretty low success rates, and naturally scientists are searching all avenues to help devise better ones. Thus far, they've found a host of gene mutations linked to glioblastoma. Benjamin Puro and David Schiff of the University of Virginia wrote the review article and are hoping that knowing more about the genetic mutations could help us personalise treatments for the cancer, making them more effective. I called Benjamin to find out how common and how serious this kind of brain cancer is.
It's not an uncommon tumor, and certainly within the top 10 cancers in a population the size of the United States, we see an incidence annually of 10 or 11,000 cases per year, and essentially they're all fatal within a fairly short time. The median survival for patients with glioblastoma, giving them the state-of-the-art therapy, is approximately 15 months at this time, and that state-of-the-art therapy includes kind of an initial surgery, taking out as much of the tumor as is safe to do, followed by a course of concurrent radiation and chemotherapy with a drug called temozolomide.
Your article in Nature Reviews Neurology looks at the potential of genetics in potentially developing new therapies and increasing our knowledge of glioblastoma. So when did this all start? It's been going on for quite a while, hasn't it, this genetic effort?
It has. I mean, this is a terrible cancer, and as is true across the board in oncology, there's been this hope that if we can dissect the genetic underpinnings that give rise to these cancers and drive their behavior, that we can do targeted therapies that specifically go after the genetics. Our current therapies, things like radiation chemotherapy, are very shotgun approaches, not targeted, and actually have limited effect. But the hope is that with better understanding of the genetics that we can make better therapies. So for decades, people have been hoping to better understand the genetics. And going back to the 1980s, there were important discoveries being made about the genetics of glioblastoma, things like amplification of the EGF receptor, and as newer technologies have been developed, it's very much been applied to glioblastoma since there's such a dire need for a better understanding of these cancers.
Now, you mentioned one receptor that was implicated, but there are another pair, aren't there, that have been more recently discovered that people were a bit surprised to see were so heavily involved, the IDH1 and IDH2 genes.
Yes, people are extremely excited about those discoveries. Initial discovery of IDH1 as a very common mutation, particularly in secondary glioblastoma, came from a high-throughput sequencing effort run by Johns Hopkins University, but with other centers involved as well, including Duke University in the United States. This couple of major high-throughput efforts came out around the same time, the Cancer Genome Atlas, as well as initial results from this major sequencing effort of a number of glioblastomas. And they sequenced many, many genes. It was over 20,000. So most of the human genome was sequenced in a number of glioblastomas. And this IDH1 gene popped out as frequently mutated. These are metabolic genes that we don't fully understand all their functions, but we have some insight into what these metabolic genes do.
Now, there are these sort of one or two clusters of genes that people have picked out as being important, but I get the idea from your article that actually a lot of the genetic background is kind of a bit of a mess.
That's very true, and a lot of us in the field have become somewhat intimidated, I think, by the genetic complexity. There have been efforts to look for overarching themes within this, particularly within certain pathways. The initial publication from the Cancer Genome Atlas effort did try to simplify things into essentially three basic pathways that need to be aberrant in pretty much every glioblastoma. And on the downside, within each of these three areas, there are sort of multiple paths, and a lot of the complexity comes from there.
I see. So take me through those, you know, once we've got this knowledge about what genes are involved, how do we turn that into treatments?
Right. So, well, it's far from a straightforward process. So, for example, we have a number of experimental agents already in the pipeline that inhibit a number of these pathways, but you know, there's still complexity involved in figuring out what's the best point in the pathway to try to address it, to try to interrupt it. So, for example, one of the critical pathways that's been found to be dysregulated in glioblastoma is the RAS pathway, and a whole lot of the inputs, a whole lot of the genetic lesions found in glioblastoma go towards driving the RAS pathway, and kind of in parallel with it, there's also the PI3 kinase AKT pathway. Both pathways can kind of help drive the other. In particular, RAS can, in some settings, help drive the PI3 kinase AKT pathway. We have drugs that can block these pathways, but at various points on these pathways, and it's really not clear yet, and we're trying to figure out how best to interrupt these pathways.
So lots of ways in, but a mixed bag so far. Now, finally, Benjamin, I wanted to get you to answer the question that you've set yourself, actually, in the title of this paper. So it says, advances in the genetics of glioblastoma, are we reaching critical mass? I mean, what's the outlook? What's the future of this field?
Sure. So where we're all hoping to take this field, and sooner rather than later, is to a point where we can do personalized medicine, essentially, or we understand the genetics so very well that we figure out a cocktail that essentially works for all patients. So given the genetic complexity and the genetic variability from one patient's glioblastoma to another's, it may well require a personalized approach where we get a patient's tumor, we will genetically characterize it, and then we hope to then match a small cocktail of these inhibitors to that patient. I mean, if we're extremely lucky, we will find a cocktail that's sort of generally useful across the board. But this is the promise that these genetic studies of glioblastoma offer. And it does seem like we're getting there.
Benjamin Puro and the Cancer Genome Atlas Project published the results that Benjamin mentioned in Nature last year. There's a link to that research on the Neuropod website. Right, that's your lot. For more neuroscience from Nature or to subscribe to any of Nature's neuro journals, check out nature.com/neurosci. For a regular oral dose of science from Nature magazine itself, you need the Nature podcast, available through iTunes or from nature.com/podcast. If you've got any feedback on Neuropod, drop me a line at neuropod@nature.com or follow Minnie Kerry on Twitter. I'm Kerry Smith. Thanks for listening.